Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Pro Basketball Talk podcast at NBC Sports. Wow, these playoffs are fun. I kind of forgot how much fun the playoffs are edition. We are going to talk some West Coast on this podcast, some Los Angeles Lakers, some Los Angeles Clippers, and we're not even going to waste time. Mark Medina, USA Today, has been following the Lakers and the Clippers and a few other teams closely, but watching this Lakers series against the Suns, and we're going to bring him right in. How you doing, Mark?
Kurt, I am, all the caveats aside, as good as can be. And to your point, it's nice that playoff basketball is back. It's been fun every single day.
It's been a blast watching Trae Young piss off all of New York and talking about the Bucks heat again and seeing the Bucks bounce back. And there's, look, Portland and Denver is going to be a fun series. Like, there's a lot of fun out there, but we're going to focus out west, and we'll start where you were watching last night. Los Angeles Lakers, Phoenix Suns, Anthony Davis and the LeBron kind of, I don't know, flip the switch, go to the LeBron at center lineups for the final minutes and pull away. But to me, is it just me? The real story of this series is how does Chris Paul feel?
Oh, without a doubt. And it's, I never have rooting interest, but the only thing I do root against is people getting hurt. And it's a real shame because it felt like and seemed like Chris Paul was turning a corner. When he got traded from Houston, Oklahoma City, some of the thought process beyond, hey, James Harden and Chris aren't getting along, was that, hey, he's just always going to get hurt during the playoffs at the most terrible time. And he proved in Oklahoma City last season that he could get healthy. He proved during this season he could be healthy. And then for a shoulder stinger to happen that they say is a contusion, it's a real thing. And injuries happen in sports, but the fact that this has continued to happen to Chris is a potential game changer.
It has been. It's really, unfortunately, for people who didn't see it, it was Cameron Johnson. It was a friendly fire injury, right? It was an elbow from a teammate kind of into that shoulder, neck, trapezius area, and it gave him what they're calling essentially a stinger. He couldn't even dribble the basketball with his right hand, for a while in that first game. Slightly better last night, but I mean, Monty Williams admitted taking him out, saying I couldn't watch him play like this. It was he was trying to gut through it, and he just couldn't be there. And they missed that at the end of the game. They miss his ability as a playmaker, right? Just as a guy who can not only get you a bucket, but more importantly, kind of just be the floor general they need.
Yeah, and the thing that I do give the credit, the Suns credit, is that their effort level and their supporting cast isn't hinged on, hey, is Chris Paul available? But the reality is you need Chris Paul to be able to make plays. You need Chris Paul to be able to make shots. And while I trust that Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton and some of their key reserves have what it takes to win a game, it's a huge game changer with Chris. And I thought in game one, beyond the fact that, hey, even if he wasn't fully 100%, there was still value in him being on the floor. He was being that, like, quote-unquote invisible leader, where because of the culture that he instituted with helping develop the young guys, have them have that same mentality, the guys didn't want to let him down. And they still had the same mindset in game two, but he was just a lot more limited. And then I think on the Lakers end, this is going to be a series, but I do wonder, is there kind of a turning point of, hey, Anthony Davis, he had a bounce back game, as was expected. This is his MO for better and for worse ever since he's been a Laker. And it seemed like they found some relative progress with LeBron James's health. They found some relative progress with the center rotation, with Andre Drummond actually being productive, Marc Gasol getting some minutes. So I think all these developments are all fluid game to game, but I do wonder, which ones will tilt the scale a lot more significantly.
Let's talk about LeBron for a second, because to me that was one of the keys. He still, last night, took three shots at the rim and nine threes, and that was after game one where it was two shots at the rim and seven threes. He still, to me, look, he's hitting his jump shots, he's making plays because he's LeBron James, but he's still not playing downhill. He's still not as explosive and aggressive as I've come to expect from LeBron. And I just feel like if he can't get back to that level, it will catch up with them at some point. That they, this is such a top-heavy Laker roster, they have to have that, you know, MVP level LeBron from the first half of the season.
Yeah, and it's weird because you see flashes of old LeBron. I remember at the beginning of the game, he was throwing down lobs and going downhill, as you mentioned. You thought, okay, like, he looks all right. I'm not a doctor, but I can pretend to be one, right? And then all of a sudden, it is him shooting a lot more threes and being more of a facilitator. And look, like, LeBron's great at those things, but you want a healthy LeBron and a fully aggressive LeBron. And the reality is, you know, Frank Vogel said before the game when I asked him just how he's been holding up, he said the shoulder's minimal soreness. So that's more of a recent injury. But the ankle, Frank Vogel's admitted that this is something that he's going to have to deal with throughout the playoffs. And while I think it's a stretch to think, to say that, hey, LeBron's playing on one leg or he's completely debilitated, he's not fully healthy. And this is something that they're going to have to manage for potentially the next 2 months if the Lakers are going to be able to get back to the finals. And so I think that's where the importance of Anthony Davis comes in. Anthony Davis has to play at his absolute best, not only because, hey, he's the second best player on the team. And while the Lakers have some decent complementary pieces, like, they're not equipped to win without him playing well. But this is also comes to illustrate that there needs to be a way to take some of the burden off of LeBron. And Anthony Davis is the most realistic option in reducing the severity of that. And that was a good sign game two. And that was kind of expected again, because that's what he's been about. But this has to be a sustainable thing moving forward, or else, you know, the Lakers aren't going to repeat it. They might not even beat the Suns in this first round series because of how good Phoenix is.
No, the Suns have played well. DeAndre Ayton in particular really kind of outplayed Davis in that first game handily, right? Like, just was able to get inside, get points, get rebounds. Davis was it 16 shots for 13 points or whatever it was in the first game. But the second game, they were really able to attack with Davis. He had 21 free throw attempts. He was getting to the line. He got Ayton and everybody else, it seemed, in foul trouble. I think that that's what you need, right? You have to have that aggressive Davis. I was still surprised they went with Drummond as long as they did, but it seemed a little more successful in game two than it did, went in game one. And like I said, Gasol got minutes. But they finally made that, was it 7-0, 8-0 run at the end of the game. I'm like, hey, we'll go to Davis at five.
Yeah, I mean, Anthony Davis inevitably is going to have to play at the five in the playoffs, because even though he doesn't like doing that, he is effective and he makes defensive stops when they need. I mean, he had that block behind DeAndre Ayton late in the game. He was able to get that steal. And I'm with you. I was surprised that Andre Drummond still got the start. I do wonder, is that a way to not necessarily massage egos, but just to minimize kind of the fallout of how that rotation is going to be? And as much as Andre struggled, him having a relegated role could even do worse. So I think, you know, it was good that Drummond held up his end of the bargain, had, I think, his best game in a Laker uniform. It was good that Marc Gasol got some time and was productive with the minutes he was given. But not to give Montrezl Harrell those minutes, I know that he is limited defensively, but he is still a hell of an offensive player. But, you know, I think the reality is Vogel knows a lot more what he's going to get defensively with other options than with Harrell, and that's where Anthony Davis comes in. Like, this is the playoffs. This is go time. He has to be willing to master, like, anything and everything, because he is so talented, number one. But also, you know, the Lakers need all those things because there's so many things that leave them vulnerable at this point with LeBron's health and the rest of the role players just – kind of being a whack-a-mole, where sometimes you get something nice and it hits and sometimes you don't. So Anthony Davis has to be the most proven and reliable option out of everyone because of all those things.
I love that description of the Lakers role players as a whack-a-mole, because it kind of is, right? Like that, but it is. Like last night was the Dennis, you know, game two Dennis Schroeder night, right? Like,
yeah
Dennis Schroeder had a good stretch, but I don't know that I'm going to bank on that night in and night out.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me interjection real quick, I'm glad you brought up Schroeder. That could be a turning point. We don't know what he's going to give night in, night out, but he had been dealing with a lot of conditioning issues ever since he came back from the protocols. He looked a lot better, and that, again, goes to not only having another option, but, hey, how to relieve pressure off of LeBron James? Well, you have another guy who can run the offense, assume some ball handling duties. But, again, with all that aside, everything still points to Davis, that he needs to be the guy that has to carry this team. And maybe he's not the number one guy because LeBron's still LeBron, but he has to have that mindset that, you know what, LeBron might not be 100%, so it's on me to carry the load.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Yeah, and I do love that, you know, Kyle Kuzma had called for some Marc Gasol earlier in the playoffs. I know you got in the final, it was about, what did you get him, like 8 or 9 minutes in the final fourth quarter on, I guess he only got a few minutes. He only got like 5 minutes, four or five minutes in the middle there. But he got key minutes in the fourth quarter. Marc Gasol does provide something. Their offense just flows more smoothly, right? The Laker, he's such a good passer, that especially if he's out there with LeBron, the ball really flies for them. It's just, it can be such a defensive liability, they can't stick with it.
Yeah, he's such a good passer, and I don't have the play-by-play in front of me, but I remember the Suns were trying to make a run, and he was able to hit a pretty significant three that, you know, gave the Lakers some cushion and kind of dialed down the momentum that the Suns were feeling, both with just how they're playing and how the crowd was in Phoenix. So, yeah, I mean, he is still an effective player. And I think the interesting thing about him is that I totally get why the Lakers made the Drummond move. Look, buyout market moves in general aren't ever significant game changers. But when you're trying to find different ways to maximize your odds of defending the title, this made sense because at the time, Gasol was dealing with his own issues with getting COVID. He never felt fully comfortable from a conditioning standpoint and a defensive standpoint that they need to have reinforcements with Drummond. But incidentally, when that happened, I think, A, that lit a fire under him a little bit of, hey, like, I got to still show my value. But B, it also coincided with, you know, more passage of time happening that he could, you know, get his wind back and his conditioning and health back after having such a tough ordeal dealing with the virus.
Yeah, it's a very good point about him not bouncing back. We haven't seen a lot of Markieff Morris in this. Limited minutes for Kyle Kuzma down the stretch, too. But Alex Caruso's out there. I mean, that guy's defense and just willingness to kind of fit into the role, he's become their small ball guy. I mean, not as much to Horton Tucker as I expected, but Caruso just makes plays.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the big picture of this, I know Frank Vogel's gotten criticisms of having such deep rotations and not tightening those up, so there's more continuity, and scrutinizing things. But it remains to be seen whether that strategy is good or not. But I do know that last year the strategy worked, and I know it's different personnel, but I think Laker fans have to keep in mind that they're dealing with similar issues at the beginning of the playoffs, where at the time Rajon Rondo wasn't healthy. In the regular season, he was seen as a liability. Guys like Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee, you had your good moments and bad moments. And by the end of the playoffs, Vogel being willing to experiment with rotations helped for matchup purposes, keeping guys engaged, but also keeping guys fresh. So that very well might be the formula that helps, you know, down the line. But at the same time, like, we don't know. And especially with this season where chemistry has been such a more pronounced challenge because of the lack of practice time and just the injury concerns that LeBron and AD had and the condensed schedule, you never know. But, you know, Vogel is willing to roll the dice on that because he thought that it worked last year, and he's determined it will this year, and we'll see how those dice turn out. Interesting stuff.
How much does it help them too in the I'm switching over to Phoenix. They just need Jay Crowder on the floor, right? Like Devin Booker, you know, we talk about Chris Paul being getting healthy, and obviously Devin Booker's kind of their big scorer. But when Jay Crowder could stay on the floor and wasn't dealing with the foul trouble in the second half, that team is just so much smoother. They could, by the way, Miami would like Jay Crowder back right about now.
Yeah.
But Jay Crowder really is the kind of just a fantastic role player who can guard multiple positions. You can put him on Anthony Davis for stretches. You can put him he was on Drummond for stretches last night. He hits threes, makes plays, just such a great veteran role player, and is thriving for the Suns, and they need him.
Yeah, does so many things. And I know that he didn't necessarily shoot the ball well in game two, but he is an offensive threat that you have to take seriously. So that just, yeah, you know, extends the defense even more. I think what he does on the defensive end, you know, relieves the workload for a guy like DeAndre Ayton, where, you know, as important as it is for him to play defense, he can channel a lot of his energy into just scoring inside a lot. And, you know, same thing with Chris Paul and Devin Booker. They are both really capable of defenders, but, you know, it all comes under, okay, how do we make this guy's job easier? And I think in Chris's case, it's huge because he's dealing with an injury. But even with all that aside, this Chris Paul injury could be pretty significant. And the reality is he doesn't need to be fully healthy for him to help the team. But if he's not out on the floor, it is such a game changer because he's able to run the offense. He has that presence that rubs off on everyone. That while I do think that the Suns have grown enough to not just be dependent on him, he's just so damn talented that there's no way other around it. So I don't want to say that this is the equivalent of Rockets Warriors from a few years back, but it very well could be, and we'll have to wait and see.
I think that, again, I think you're right. It just ultimately comes down to where Chris Paul is. But I still feel like, the Lakers, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you'd say, well, the Lakers stole one on the road. They come home 1-1. That's a good start to a series. This series still feels like it goes 6 or 7 to me. Like, it still feels like a bit of a toss-up. I obviously, that hinges on Chris Paul's health, but Phoenix has played them pretty well, and the Lakers haven't really shown the ability to just dominate this series yet.
Yeah, it goes either way. And sure, having home court helps. This is going to be the first Laker playoff game since 2013. It's surreal to think.
That's kind of wild.
Crazy to think that the last time the Lakers was in the playoffs was when Dwight Howard got ejected in game 4 in their first round series.
Oh my gosh.
Against the San Antonio Spurs, and Kobe Bryant's coming out the bench because, you know, he had injured his Achilles a few weeks earlier. Oh my gosh. It's crazy how 8 years has passed. So I know that adrenaline rush is going to come in, even if the amount of fans isn't the equivalent as what was allowed in Phoenix. But I think the reality is, when you look at all the factors, it's all going to be health. It's all going to be how well the star players are performing. That I think that because of how evenly matched these teams are, well, the home court or having to win on the road, it's not going to be as big of a deal as it would be maybe in a traditional 2-7 matchup. So yeah, I'm bracing for a 6-7 game series that will be decided in crunch time.
Can I say, by the way, just how great it is to have fans back in the building? And, you know, obviously neither of us were in Madison Square Garden or some of the arenas that have been completely full, but, you know, we've both been in arenas now with fans back in there. It just brings an energy, even if it's, you know, a third capacity or whatever. Just the energy that's going on in the building with that many people is so great. And the players really feed off of it, and it brings, it just makes the whole thing feel, I don't know, there was just a weird hollowness without it. And now with the playoffs, it just feels more normal.
Yeah, it's crazy. LeBron James was saying the other day that as much as he hasn't experienced what a playoff game is like in a Laker uniform, he made the good point that Lakers-Warriors playing game felt like a playoff atmosphere.
Oh, it was.
It was being there.
Yeah.
It definitely brought me reminders back of what it was like at Staples Center when the Lakers or Clippers were playing for stakes. And look, it's still an adjustment. Everyone has to do the right thing with the health and safety protocols. The Clipper game, for example, is a little amusing that to compensate for the fact that at the time, I think it's still only up to 7,000 fans
It's 7,000 now, yeah.
Nearly 19,000 person capacity at Staples Center, that they had all these cardboard cutouts. I think things like that are tacky, but the reality is any amount of fans is better than no fans. And I know being in the bubble for 2 months in Orlando and seeing a few games at Staples Center at the beginning of the season where they had ring night, you know, there were, it was just weird. The fans bring this whole other element to the game that, you know, people knew about beforehand, but it's one of those things that you don't truly know how valuable it is until you lose it. And yeah, it's just, it's also, I think the bigger thing, it's fortunately a nice sign that as much as we're still in the middle of a pandemic and there's a lot of challenges, at least this represents some semblance of how we're moving in the right direction.
I was at the Clipper game, and I think we'll start talking about them here in a second, but I was at the Clipper game and my first reaction was exactly yours. Cardboard cutouts. Why is that? I mean, it just looks, like you said, tacky or weird or almost dated. Like, well, we don't do that anymore. Like, we've got fans in the building. The people with NBA TV, and I'm not going to name names, but there are people with NBA TV who are telling you, nah, it's fine. Like, it looks good. It looks, it's better this than like empty seats. And I'm like, is it? I don't know that it really was. And it, what was strange was at the game, they have a vaccinated section, which is much, has a lot more people kind of packed into it. But for what I believe were logistical reasons with the way the arena set up, it was not on the side the cameras shoot at. It's not at the, not behind the benches. It was opposite that. So you couldn't really see it unless they made a specific camera pan over to it. You didn't see it like in the standard shot. It was a little strange. And I thought it looked, I'm with you. I did not like the cardboard cutout look. And hopefully, I would say hopefully they'll be able to adjust that and get more fans in there. I don't know how much longer we'll be seeing the Clippers. They may not have to deal with that for a second round if they don't make some changes pretty quick.
Yeah, it's crazy. I thought finally this is the year that the Lakers and the Clippers actually meet in the playoffs. And yet again, it looks like that's not going to happen. Now, that being said, I didn't have any illusions throughout this season that all of a sudden the Clippers have changed their stripes. I was always in this kind of wait and see mode, because I would see stretches of the Clippers playing really well and then laying an egg for a few games. George being inconsistent, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George having different injury things, that no matter what they did from a coaching standpoint, replacing Doc Rivers and Ty Lue, getting Serge Ibaka essentially to replace Montrezl Harrell, and having there be a relatively better bill of health with their star players and Kawhi and Paul, that I was always skeptical that their identity changed. And it looks like I was validated in that. I know that the Mavericks are great. Luka Doncic is an amazing player. It was surreal seeing his dominant performance in game one in person and to see his game two performance in game two. But on paper, the Clippers are much better than the Mavericks. The Mavericks have Luka Doncic, and sure, Kristaps Porzingis is okay, but he's not the same player that he once was. And they have a bunch of role players that are fine. They're great. They're not scrubs, but they're not game changers. Where the Clippers, they have on paper two of the elite players in the NBA and Kawhi and PG. They have a lot of depth. They have, you know, different positional needs that are filled. They have a good coach, and it's just not playing together, and it's just inexcusable. But it is amusing to see the same story playing out, because while I don't have any rooting interest, I don't care one way or the other, it is entertaining to see all the punchlines thrown their way. But it is also disappointing from a writer's standpoint, because we all want cool stories, that it looks like we won't see that Laker-Clipper playoff showdown once again.
I don't. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not sure that that's happening. I was at that game. Part of it. Look, let's start here. Luka's been unbelievable in this series, and we kind of expected that. But I'm 39 points last night, but absolutely carving them up. But just hitting just crazy shots. And the Clippers did a much better job in the second. By the way, maybe the shot of the game, and I don't know if anybody remembers, it's right at the end before the half. They decide to go for a 2-for-1. Doncic dribbling left across, shoots back across his body, flying across, and just drains it like it's nothing. Like it's like a 22-footer going back across my body. Just got to get a shot up so we can get this 2-for-1. Oh, got that. All right, now we'll move on. Just incredible all night long. He absolutely flat out hunted, though, the Clipper defenders. They did a better job of putting Paul George and Kawhi Leonard on him, but they switch a little too easily for my taste. And so they'd get Zubac on him, or he'd get Beverly or any of the point guards on him, anybody else. And he back them down and score. And what's really been the difference in this series, and certainly was the difference in game two, they're shooting 50% from three. And in game two, the combination of Porzingis and Tim Hardaway Jr. and Kleba were 11 of 14 from three. So you start to throw everything at Luka, like we've got to get this stopped. And the other guys are just knocking down their shots. And when that happens, Dallas becomes an offensive force. It's really tough to stop. Clippers put up 71 points in the first half, or 73 points in the first half. And it was like, it was an offensive show, and it still wasn't enough because they can't, this team's defense, which should be a calling card, just does not have an answer. Just does not have an answer for Dallas. And I think they could absolutely tighten things up. Their rotations got weird. They struggled with when the ball really moved. But even if they tightened that up, if these guys are hitting those shots like at 50%, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And I'm glad that they made some adjustments game two to game one. But I don't understand from the jump why it took so long for Ty Lue to put Kawhi on Luka to begin with. At the beginning of the game, they're having him on Porzingis. And I know that he's a threat from inside and out. And Ty Lue's explanation was this. A, you know, in today's game, you all have to defend 1 through 5 anyway, and people switch, and he didn't want Kawhi to get in foul trouble. But I think Kawhi can be such a tone setter that, you know, having a guy like Luka, while he's always going to be due for having a magnificent performance, if you limit the damage early, it's a lot easier to set that tone than playing catch-up, as opposed to what they did in the second half where they started trapping him at half court and he wore down. That's number one. Number two, this isn't so much of a Ty Lue coach, and I think it's just more of an identity with the Clippers. I don't like their attitude at all. Like, they, you know, while it is good to be calm and not, you know, pointing fingers at things, I think everyone playing off them being down 0-2, it sent the wrong message, number one. And I'm waiting for someone like Kawhi or Paul George to point the finger at themselves. It's kind of like what Anthony Davis did after game one, where it's like, hey, it's on me. And even if it's too simplistic and it's a team game, like, put the burden on you and take up the challenge. Like, while I do credit Paul George's game one performance in particular, it wasn't like the bubble where he's hitting shots off the side of the backboard and just not engaged at all. Like, he didn't shoot well, but he was still being aggressive. I didn't see him trying to go the extra nth mile to make up for it on defense. And, you know, it's sad because I think individually Kawhi is still one of the best players in the game. He is remarkably efficient, but I think his stoic personality, as well as Paul George's stoic personality, that has, even if it's unintended, it doesn't have a good trickle-down effect for the rest of the team. And, we'll see if that changes during the series. But this is a huge hole to climb out of, being down 0-2, having a win on the road. And it's against a Dallas team that's really good.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say that it's impossible, but if I had to put money on it, the Mavericks are going to maybe not sweep the series, but they're going to win it.
I look, obviously Dallas is the favorite. Now, normally I would say, you know, you lost two at home. This is over, you know, this is over. This is done. I think the only series I might say that about right now is Boston and Brooklyn. That looks pretty done.
Yeah, that was over before the series even started.
That one's done. This one I don't, again, only because, as I said, Dallas's role players are hitting their shots at such an unsustainable pace that I have a feeling that this is going to come back to earth a little and it opens the door for the Clippers. But you're right. They remain calm. And the only guy who wasn't on the guy who was pointing fingers, was Rondo, who's, as everybody knows, just insanely fiery competitive. They've got him. They do miss, by the way, Serge Ibaka, who played 6 minutes in this game. And what I mean is they don't just miss, like, wow, they should play him more because he's not moving well. They miss the idea of Serge Ibaka. They miss why they went and got Serge Ibaka in the offseason, the guy who can protect the rim, space the floor on offense, you know, hedge out and recover. Without his ability to play meaningful minutes and play well, now you're really in trouble because you've either got to go crazy small, which is what they did at the end of the game where Paul George and Kawhi Leonard were the tallest players on the floor for the Clippers, or you've got to have Zubats or somebody else out there who's just getting torched. I mean, they're just torching him. They can't really play him many more minutes. I don't know if they can even start him. It keeps starting him the way that Dallas is just attacking him. And the challenges, and I don't, they miss that, but I'm with you. I would like a little fire. They clearly, from top to bottom, and Ty, it starts with Ty Lue too, right? They kept saying in the post game Zoom that I was on, you know, with them at the arena, they're all like, we're not concerned. We think we can do it. But you should be concerned. You absolutely should be concerned.
Yeah. And the rhetoric after game two was similar to when they were squandering the series lead against Denver, where, you know, even when Denver forced a game seven, Paul George is saying, we're in the driver's seat. It's like, no, you're not. Like, you were about to be vulnerable, and then it wound up happening. And I know that, you know, in fairness compared to last year, you know, the account suggests that, hey, Ty Lue's been more innovative with the offense, tinker rotations, had a different approach. But the reality is, Doc has been a good head coach for a while. So while you may want to scrutinize, okay, what did he really need to play Montrezl Harrell so many minutes when he was struggling defensively? Did his voice eventually become tuned out? At the end of the day, this is on the players. And you can also add that to kind of the moving parts of, hey, Rondo, is his demanding leadership, is it a good thing or a bad thing? I think for the most part, it's good, but sometimes, like in the heat of the moment in game two, sometimes it can backfire because usually you like to have those moments during the prep time and behind the scenes where in the middle of a game it could create a further meltdown. And also Ibaka, like, hey, he misses, 31 games during the season. That adds to the lack of continuity in the practice time. But the reality is this. The Clippers, again, have Paul George and Kawhi Leonard on their team. Like, they are talented enough and they should be having the mindset enough that, you know, to hell with it, they're carrying this for better and for worse. You know, the Lakers season hasn't been pretty by any means. And they've struggled as well, most notably with LeBron and AD being out. But I think the thing that I do give them credit for is as they've tried to improve their health, they've had this mentality of, you know what, even if it looks ugly, we're going to drag everyone along with us. And while AD may have lacked that in game one, he had the self-awareness immediately. Hey, I got to get my act together or else we're going to lose. And then he made the adjustments within a few days. And I just don't see that with how the Clippers stars are playing. And it's, again, I mean, it doesn't matter to me. I'm not playing, but just from an objective observer, it's disappointing that they haven't had enough awareness to course correct after, you know, them going through the same old story the last two seasons.
Let me ask you then the millions of dollars question. All season long, anybody I've talked to, the buzz you've probably heard around the league, everybody I've talked to is Kawhi's not going anywhere. Kawhi fought too hard to become a Clipper. He is not leaving this franchise at this point. He, you know, he wants to win here. He got Paul George here. He wants to be home. All of that is still true. But if he gets bounced, if the Clippers do get bounced in the first round by Dallas, does it change his free agency?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I say that being that I don't think that changes his free agency at all. But at the same time, only Kawhi knows that. And no matter what he says, who knows? And in today's NBA, things can change. But I do think that he's coming back regardless. I think the question is, and I got to caution that this isn't coming from anywhere. This is just me looking at it, is that if they underachieve, are the Clippers better off thinking, you know what, like, we got to cut our losses with Paul George and find a deal that works where we can get some assets in return? Because as blasphemous as that might sound, because Paul is such a good player, and one of the reasons why they got Kawhi to begin with was it was the idea that they were going to make a deal to get Paul. They had to give up a lot to make that happen, and they haven't had the benefits. And regardless of what Paul had said last year of, hey, like, our championship window wasn't this season, it actually was. And maybe it's unfair for championship-constructed teams to think, hey, if you don't win a finals at all, it's a failure. But clearly there was a difference between last year with how the season ended versus, hey, they got to the Western Conference Finals against the Lakers, or they got to the NBA Finals against whoever, Miami, and they just lost a really competitive series. This was them having self-inflicted wounds and them just not playing up to their potential. It's the same way here. So I'm not saying that this is how the Clippers are thinking, but if they do underachieve, I think that's how they should be thinking, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that they tinkered on the edges last year. Hey, we're going to, you know, Lou Williams is out, Montrezl Harrell is out because that wasn't working chemistry-wise in the locker room. And Serge Ibaka is on paper exactly what they need in a better fit. But the fact of the matter is they're gone in the first round. I'm not sure. You're going to have a very frustrated owner who canned his coach last year in frustration. You're going to see moves. I think you're going to see some aggressive moves from them.
Yeah, and I would add, and this applies to the Nets, this applies to the Lakers, this could apply to the Clippers. Like, the idea of if either of those teams don't win a championship, how do you define their season? Well, obviously all those teams have a certain window. That's their expectation. But it's not so much did they win or did they lose. It's how the result came to be. So in the Nets case, if they get to the finals or even the East finals and it's just, hey, it's a competitive series or there's health things, you don't write that off as a failure. It is first year. You have to align everything with the Lakers. Hey, they won a title last year. Maybe health plays a factor. You run it back. Same thing with the Clippers. But clearly the way things are going with the Clippers, a potential losing in the first round versus getting far and meeting the Lakers in the West finals. Yeah. And it's just a really competitive series. It's completely different. And so I think if they're able to get their act together and they get to that point, hey, how they evaluate things may or should change. But the way things are now, I think it's all about moving in a different direction.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting offseason for Lawrence Frank and company. By the way, one quick question, speaking of interesting offseasons, how aggressive is a team you used to cover, Golden State, going to be this offseason?
Yeah, it's interesting. Bob Myers did his exit interview, recently after their season ended not too long ago. And he was saying, like, we owe it to Steph Curry to give him a championship contending roster. And after the season ended, you know, Steph made it clear the way he played this season could work if there's the right pieces around him. Draymond Green is saying we're a ways away from being where we need to be because we didn't make the playoffs. So if I'm reading between the lines, they have to go all in. And what that means is they can't wait for James Wiseman to hope that, hey, he's coming back next season, a better player, and hope that they can hit on the draft. They need to use those players as assets and deals. And while it goes without saying that them getting Klay Thompson back expectedly next season significantly changes things. There's also an element of an unknown of when he's coming back. You know, Myers had suggested that him coming back for the season opener is probably too soon. Klay said that himself. You never know that. While I do trust that he will still be a really good player, will he be the same player that he was pre-injury? That might be saying much. And then also, how long will it take for his condition to come back? So with all that said, it sounds like because of the feedback Steph and Draymond are giving them and that they know that they don't want to squander, you know, those years, that they are going to go all in, but it's a matter of how do they execute it. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, 72% chance they get that Minnesota pick. Remember, they get it out of the D'Angelo Russell trade. If it's not top three, it's top three protected. It's 4 or 6 or 7 or 8. They get it. That pick plus their own pick plus Wiseman, and you're willing to spend as an ownership, I think you can shake this thing up. I think you can bring in veterans. You let Oubre go, and you go another direction probably. And I think you're going to see some aggressive moves there because I'm with you. They got to be all in. This is a now thing, and you can rebuild in a few years.
Yeah. It's look, sometimes these moves work, sometimes they don't. But when you're in the moment, you can't worry about, okay, well, where's this going to be a few years from now? Because at that point, you may not have a Steph Curry or a Klay Thompson or Draymond Green on your team. You have to just be willing to live for the potential benefits or consequences of that. And when it gets to that point where you have to turn a new leaf, you do. But while you're in the moment, you have to think short term than long term. This isn't a situation where, hey, you have some decent players and you're trying to build continuity. No, you have a generational talent and two other all-star caliber players that were part of a dynasty. And while it's fool's gold to think that the Warriors can be what they once were, they still have that championship window. And so just say hypothetically, the Warriors don't do that and they decide, hey, we're going to use these draft picks to select players and we're going to have Wiseman back. And hey, we keep some of the promising young players that we have that showed growth this year with Juan Toscano-Anderson and Jordan Poole. Ooh. Like, look, this isn't a scrub team. If this was a scrub team, they wouldn't have even been close to making the playoffs, even with Steph Curry having an MVP-type season. But this idea of, hey, let's just build off of this past season, they couldn't make the playoffs with that formula. And it's also not fair to Steph because as much as you think, hey, Steph showed he can do what he can do, to ask him to do that again is unfair because a lot of what you saw this past season had to do with the fact that he had extended time off from, you know, his injury.
Yep.
They weren't in the bubble. And I don't want to say that it's a fluke because it's Steph Curry, but it's also asking too much of him to say, hey, we're just going to have you score 40 points a night to carry us. So, yeah, they got to go all in. If they don't, they're going to be right back where they were before, where they're going to be up and down. They may compete for an eighth seed, but maybe not. And then it's just it could be the equivalent of what set off Kobe Bryant when he was in his prime and he demanded a trade. So, you know, that is while I don't think Steph would go that route that Kobe did because they're different personalities. There was a different dynamic at the time with both front offices. I think that illustrates, you know, the danger of doing that and also illustrates the positive that, hey, eventually they made a deal and they got Pau Gasol and they're back on the hunt again. And I think the Warriors could do the same thing.
Yep. And the West isn't going to get any softer, by the way. Like
exactly.
Dallas is getting better. Phoenix will get better. Denver is young and improve, you know, still probably improving and theoretically gets Jamal Murray back at some point next season, hopefully, knock on wood, and the rest of it. So it doesn't get easier in the West. LeBron James doesn't age. So it's going to continue. You're going to have to go all in. I'm with you. I think they have to be crazy aggressive this summer. And the problem might be just we'll see who's available. We'll see what you can actually do because I'm not sure. We'll see how much talent is out there to really move around. I got a lot of guys locked up this year and not a lot of guys are pushing around. So we'll see.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. But I mean, I guess the best way to crystallize this is that if the Warriors don't make moves, what they're looking at is they have Wiseman, who, you know, showed some positive things, but also a lot of growing pains. And we don't know how, you know, when he's coming back. You have some potential top picks, but those are always unknowns of how long you reap the benefits of young players. And then you have a mid-level exception, and those are never game changers. Those are solid rotation guys.
Yep.
So you look at that versus the possibility of, you know, putting together Wiseman and those picks as assets and maybe a handful of some of the decent Warrior role players. That can net you a lot more than just running it back.
Exactly. Mark, thanks for doing this. I will see you tomorrow night, Thursday night. I think we'll both be at Staples Center. I'll buy you a cold roast beef sandwich.
Looking forward to it.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for doing this. Thanks a lot for listening. By the way, later this week, Dan Feldman will have Andy Larson from Salt Lake Tribune to talk Jazz and some other West playoff series and some other playoffs as well. So tune in for that, and thank you for listening. This is the Pro Basketball Talk podcast at NBC Sports.